Stoughton, from my house to yours. Welcome to EMS at Sea Level. I am here today with Michael Lucia from Benchmark. Michael, you're in the supply chain team. Give me a quick introduction to yourself and what your team do there.
Yeah, Michael Lucia with Benchmark, Director of Global Supply Chain Solutions, sometimes called Supply Chain Architect. I think I like that name better. When you have the name solutions in your title, people seem to think you always have the answer. I try to, but these days it's a challenge for sure. It's really more of a customer facing role. I work with our customers mostly on the new business side and with some of the existing accounts for some of the larger, more complex products and account structures. And help them architect their supply chain essentially to create the most value and minimize the risk that they have in those supply chains.
Okay. And I spotted an article that Jennifer McAlpine wrote on the Benchmark blog where she talked to you about design for supply chain. And it kind of made me think, you know, surely everybody's doing this. Surely everybody should be doing this, but maybe everybody's not. Where are we in with the adoption of that? Are you finding people are coming to you that really haven't thought very, very much about their supply chain when they've designed a product?
So put simply, yes. People are coming to me with a lot of questions. People are coming to me with fears. Some of the larger customers that maybe have put a little more thought into it have some pre-thought out ideas. You know, one of the first questions I ask is, you know, have you already placed parts on order? And right. I hope they say yes, but sometimes they haven't. So it's certainly still a new concept. And yeah. Like you, it's always kind of been second nature for me. And I think the events we've seen in the world here over the past few years has really transformed it from maybe what we would call supply chain risk mitigation, if even acknowledging it at all, to really looking at how does product design influence risk in the supply chain.
Yeah. And when you at Benchmark look at risk, you know, we went through a trade war, we went through a pandemic, we've now got probably the toughest component shortage most of us have seen in a generation. It feels like one disruption after another. We've potentially got an economic shock on the horizon or on the near horizon. Do you view that disruption's just a way of life and you're planning for disruption, or do you think of it as a relatively modest risk and something that you're looking to protect against?
I think that's what it's transforming into the needing to plan for disruption. What all the events you just mentioned, I think have taught us over very recent history here is the fragility of these supply chains of shipping across the globe, of ability to get components, the impact that stopping production in entire parts of the world for extended periods of time can have not only on the supply but on the demand side as well when they do turn back on, right? So a lot of this is a consequence now of those impacts, and it's very clear how fragile these supply chains can be, and it merits taking some time to think through what can happen, what can go wrong. And how can I set it up? How can I set up my product so that it's logistically efficient, so that if something does occur, you can address it a little bit more easily?
Yeah. And has that changed your job in the last 4 years? Has it changed the role you have in it, and has it changed the importance that customers put on it?
So I'm relatively new to Benchmark. I'm at Benchmark now. About a year and a half. I spent most of my career really over on the OEM side, but I'll say it as a student of EMS. I worked for some large OEMs, Lockheed Martin, Honeywell, and I was always on the new product introduction side of things. And you need to be fastest athlete there. Anywhere where you can recover schedule and reduce risk is good. A lot of times programs or even customers will pay for that. So it's kind of always been in my blood to kick a product off or start a product up in production and think through how to reduce risk, how to get lower overall product costs, and really how to simplify it in case something goes wrong, be ready to react.
Yeah. When I look at it, and when I've spoken to a lot of EMS companies and some OEMs, actually, we've talked very much about this pendulum that swings between just in time and just in case. And it's moved very much towards the just in case now. And as you mentioned before, you're asking people if they've already ordered components because lead times are ridiculously long. Inventories are probably higher than they've ever been. Mm-hmm. Do you think that balance has shifted substantially? And again, does that change the way you architect a supply chain that you know some of the stuff is going to be at least on a 52-week lead time?
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot more conversation around the just in case side of it these days. Mm. Companies in general are more open, some even happy to hold inventory. Inventory was a bad word.
It was the enemy, wasn't it?
Yeah. And optimizing inventory was considered a world-class strategy. Mm. Now, while too much inventory is certainly still very much a bad thing, having safety stock, looking at multiple sources of supply, dual sourcing, these types of strategies are very much in the mainstream and very much being looked at so that you can recover from those disruptions we were just talking about.
Yeah. And just quickly on where the market's going, do you see it easing at the moment, or are we in a steady state of long lead times?
Slightly easing on maybe on the component side, particularly on the higher performance type components that are maybe consumed mostly by telecom, compute, and even some higher end consumer goods. They're still very highly constrained for the industrials, for aerospace, defense. I think what we would call the higher value markets, right?
Yeah.
Because they're still utilizing the types of components that have been in production for some time, and yeah. I don't think the component manufacturers are really investing in additional capacity there. They're more focused on the newer technologies.
Yeah.
What Benchmark referred to as the build to print side or custom components, things like metals or plastic fab. I've talked with friends, and you know they tell me as we see the economy, or at least the industry, better words, the industry recover from the pandemic. I mean, there's fabrication houses out there that shut down large parts of their operation, laid off workers, and people moved away, to different geographies. And if you're not in a major city, getting people back into that small town is certainly impeding your ability to ramp up. So labor shortages are weighing into this too. And I'm sure that's seeing the component side as well. And it's a global phenomenon.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Who'd have thought, Michael, you can't just switch the supply chain off like a tap and expect it to turn back on immediately. It's a lesson that hopefully is learned. So having established the strategy, let's talk a little bit about the how-to. What are the things that OEMs should be thinking about when they're designing the product? And what are some of the tools you use to review their design and their bill of materials to make sure it's fit for disruption, fit for supply chain?
Yeah, so when you're starting product design or even revisiting it, it's never too early to start the conversation with the supply chain or the operations team. Mm. If that's your EMS or your contract manufacturing partner or your own factory just down the hall or downstairs, it's never too early to bring them into the discussion. Have them start looking at bills of material. Have them start looking at designs. Start the conversation of where do we want to source these things from? Do we want to do a dual source strategy? What's our end market? What localities do we want to be manufacturing the build to print components in or parts in? I think of metals and plastics and cables, things that require a lot of touch labor, right? How can we have the shortest parts list possible, right? How can we design in less parts? The common one I always think of is, you know, can you get to, you know, one type of screw, one type of hardware that you're going to use to connect everything together? Why do I need to have four different screw types? And sometimes there's reasons, but you should really be asking those questions. There's a lot of good design best practices to get to the smallest or the shortest BOM that you can. And having that team on the operations, on the sourcing side, on the supply chain side, have those conversations with design engineers early on. It's inexpensive to make changes, right? If suppliers have a chance to, or manufacturing partners have a chance to look at designs before you release the drawings, it's a lot less expensive for you as the OEM to implement that feedback and make those changes, which likely results in a lower cost and more easily obtainable product for you.
Yeah. And how deep should people be going? Should they be going several layers deep in their supply chain, or, you know, in the case of Benchmark, if you're their primary contract manufacturer, should they be relying on you to be going deep in the supply chain? Because what I've seen is people saying, hey, yeah, I've got two sources for this component. And the truth of the matter is that there's something going into that component that both of their sources are getting from the same place. And if that gets disrupted, they're in the same trouble as if they were a single source. So how deep do you go? How deep should customers go?
Well, if you're the contract manufacturer or the EMS partner, right, you probably need to go as deep as you can, all the way to the bottom of the BOM, down to the component level. One of the first things I'll do is look at the electronic components, because that's generally the longest lead parts right now. Even versus getting a casting done, it tends to be the electronic components that take the longest. So you want to analyze that right away. You want to understand, when are prototypes needed? When are maybe physical qualification unit needed, or some kind of production pedigree? And when are you ramping to flow rate production? Measure that out in weeks. Look at your BOM and quote the delivery lead time for every component. And you can typically snap a line somewhere in that BOM. Everything above, if you start ordering today, you'll have in time, and everything below, you won't. And then quickly, you can start having conversations about the parts below the line. And maybe you can get them from brokers. Maybe brokers aren't an option for you. Maybe you're in an industry like medical or defense, and you really don't want to go down that route. Okay, well, let's go back to the engineering team and have conversations about if alternates are possible. Maybe there's drop-in replacements. Maybe you need to respin. Again, a lot less expensive to do during the design phase versus something that's in mature production. And then as you, the second part of that question, I think, is the trend has really been for OEMs to buy higher in the BOM. And I think for the contract manufacturing side is to build higher in the BOM, because it's better for everybody. The OEMs are managing less suppliers, so it's less taxing, it's less overhead on them. And for the contract manufacturers, there's more value add. There's more meat on the bone for them.
Yeah. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. And what you're talking about is very, very complex for a single product. You're doing it for multiple products. You're doing it for multiple customers. It's not just a workbook full of spreadsheets. What kind of tools have you got, and do your customers have some visibility into those tools? What I think is interesting recently, Michael, is I think 5 years ago, everybody was talking to me about the glass factory and the idea that I could see into the factory and see where stuff is. People aren't talking about that at all at the moment. They're talking about the idea of a glass pipeline, where they know where everything is in their supply chain. That's more important, because that's actually where the risk has been shown to lie. So what kind of tools do you use, and how does that look to the customer?
Yeah, so the common ones on the component side you can use, and I think they're pretty common in industry. IHS is a fantastic tool. Silicon Expert will do a lot of this as well. Kinaxis Rapid Response, I use that probably on a daily basis, just to understand how material looks for us across the globe and for our customers. I've had customers get a look at some of these outputs and ask me for regular reporting on some of it, so that they can have that glass pipeline and see as well into some of that. And you know, some of our most intelligent customers, I think, are developing some of their own tool sets where they want these things to kind of be an input into that, so that they've almost got down to the piece part level, 24 month look into what's coming into Benchmark or their CM. It's a lot of progress is being made on this side. I have a lot of people contacting me about new tools or new software that's coming out in this area. It's a big market, and there's certainly a lot of entrepreneurs out there and developers out there trying to seize that moment and bring some new technology to market.
Yeah, I think that's great. And what I've seen is some people that have that technology talent and muscle behind them, but also have a few decades of supply chain experience, particularly in the EMS industry, which probably, as you've learned in the last 18 months, is a unique industry and has its own challenges and not huge margins to manage those challenges, but huge scale and huge complexity. So it's kind of an interesting sector. The last question I wanted to ask was, as we've been through these disruptions, particularly the most recent ones, one of the big challenges has been this visibility and predictability in the supply chain. And that puts pressure on your relationship with the OEMs that you work with the customers mm-hmm. that you work with. Do you think as you come out of this, there's been a kind of rethinking of the collaboration and the partnership you have with customers? And is that closer? Is it a question of a relationship where what doesn't kill you makes you stronger?
I think a lot of relationships have been tested, both existing and new, because of this. That visibility into, just talking about the clear to build piece and when you're getting parts. A lot of surprises have happened here over the past couple of years, and even still, we're seeing it today. We see suppliers decommit or OE or component manufacturers extend out lead times, with rather short notice. It's still happening today, and I think we've done a really good job explaining this to the customers about what the environment is. A lot of them still don't understand. And maybe they're launching a product for the first time. Maybe they're feeling a little tired of the escalations coming to them and they feel it's something that we're not doing, but it's an industry-wide phenomenon, right? And what we tell them is, a 24 month rolling forecast from you is the best tool to keep us regular on part procurement and having the line of sight to get those components. 24 months is going to give you almost a 104 week lead time, right? So that's going to encompass all but the most challenging components to get and probably just leave those unannounced pushouts or decommits that you're seeing from the supply base, which is manageable. Yeah. Has it strengthened it? I believe it will. I think we'll look back on this in a couple of years when things stabilize a little bit, and we'll talk about the challenges that we got through as business partners. At that point, I think it will make the relationship stronger. But we've had some tough conversations, with customers over the past couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, right now it feels a little bit like the house is on fire, so we've got to deal with that rather than rearranging the furniture. But I do think that as we move forward in the industry, we are moving from this idea of a services provider to a real partnership. And you're having to play that very important role in the supply chain because you're sitting between the OEM and most of that supply base. And as you say, some of the component manufacturers, component distributors have made that job difficult with decommits and pushing stuff out. So some big challenges. I think the important takeaway, and I guess you would agree, Michael, is that, getting onto that design, thinking about that design in terms of where the supply chain's coming from, what might happen, because as I said, we've had one disruption after another. There'll be another one. We don't know what it's going to be, so we don't know what the challenge is. But we need to be ready for it. So it's get on this stuff early, isn't it?
Yeah. And I keep going back to the sooner you can do it and engage with your supply chain, the better, and start talking through the what can go wrong and designing your product and designing your supply chain too. We didn't talk too much about that, but designing your supply chain so it can react. You know, I remember a time when, you know, if you were going to source electronics, you know, Asia was the go-to, and I questioned that with some people and said, hey, why don't? And remember, now I'm coming from the new product side, so it was pretty high touch. Why aren't we looking at building something in Mexico? And yeah. I'm just remembering your previous episode, everyone told me, oh no, you're crazy. They'll never meet the same cost as you'll get in Southeast Asia. But now what do we see? We no one's really talking about the cost difference, which by the way isn't too different anymore.
No, isn't that huge? That's right.
But people like the fact that they're on the same time zone. They can pick up the phone and they can talk to the factory manager that day. They can get there on an airplane the same day if they really had to. That's worth something. There's a recognition of that. So simplifying the supply chains, having things closer to home, smaller BOMs, less suppliers to manage, and getting a head start on long lead part procurement. These are the things that are talked about very much with all of our customers. And a lot of times some of the smartest ones, they initiate those conversations with us.
Yeah.
And we're happy to contribute.
Yeah. And I think what you're saying there is a huge part of it, because, you know, one of the challenges and disruptions we've seen and we're almost expecting more of a geopolitical challenges. So we have to think long and hard about our supply chain geography. And as you say, it's designed for supply chain, but it's also design of supply chain. And if that pendulum's swinging from just in time to just in case, there's potentially a cost for that. And in many cases, when you think through the cost of a disruption, the cost of failing to deliver, that's much higher. So that cost is very, very justifiable. So you've got to do some modeling and some planning on that basis.
Absolutely. If you if you don't have product to sell, it doesn't matter how much less it costs you, right?
That's right. That discount's suddenly worth nothing if you haven't got anything being shipped to you. Michael, thanks so much for your time. Pleasure to chat to you. I'm sure we'll chat again. I think, you know, for me, when I look at the last 12 months, the supply chain guys have been the rock stars of the industry, been working ridiculously hard, plenty of stress and plenty of pressure on you guys and your team. So great job. And thanks again for your time today.
No, it was great being here. Thank you for having me.